passada no centro.
Guys, I welcome you to another exciting episode of Soccer Talk FC Podcast, the World Cup edition. My name is JB. Let me apologize up front. My voice is quiet. I'm just recovering from a very bad cold. And that also explained why I was not able to roll out the concluding part of the group stage review. But today, I'll be having a conversation with Jide. For sake of context, Jide is my elder brother. And it's been a long time coming on this football journey. Now, today we'll be reflecting on some parts of this journey. We'll be speaking about moments that were heartbreaking for Jide, and yet were breathtaking and life-defining moments for me. We'll be talking about the World Cup and how winning the World Cup defies how a GOAT should be determined. I mean, does if winning the World Cup is what really define being a GOAT, or if it's a criteria that can be overlooked, it's another conversation that we have. We did a review of the World Cup group stage, and we had some conversation around Morocco 87, some life lessons, and also parental advice. I can bet you it's going to be exciting. Thank you so much for joining us, and enjoy. Take it from here.
No,
I'm fine, thank you. I'm pleased to be talking to you today.
All right, yeah, I mean, I'm especially excited because I feel this is something that is long overdue. I mean, I cannot believe this is the first time me and you individually are making our first podcast talking football. Considering the history and how long we have been together, how much we have known the game, there's no way I talk about my own football cycle that I don't refer back to you, because I remembered, for instance, my first World Cup experience. I have flashes of France, Italy 90, but my first clear experience was USA 94. And I remembered watching it with you. I remembered the Tunisia 94. I remembered Japan 93. I mean, these are competitions that when I started watching was when I started finding my footprints in the game, and you held my hand all through then, teaching me about the game. So, I mean, it's so exciting to look back today, see how it's been, see how the game has evolved to what it is today. And to be having this podcast with you today, I mean, it's just very exciting for me.
Well, I understand what you mean when you say that it has taken so long, but you know, life happens. You know, sometimes, you know, we've been talking about this for a while, but we just never got to do it. And most of the things we've been doing over time has been, you know, to just publish prints. But I mean, here we are today. I'm excited too. I'm really ready to go. I mean, you just brought back those parties. It feels really, really nostalgic. I remember in our dad's sitting room when we were really watching the Japan 93 match with Kano Wanko and all of that, when the neighbors came to the house, and even Atalanta 96, you know, it all goes back, and you know, all the memories are just even flooding in.
Between that time and now,
but here we are today, you know.
Yeah, and for the listeners, for sake of context, God bless the soul of our mother, but a number of times our mother would ask me, is it only football that you and Jide talk about? And that is because, you see, over these years, we talk football almost every time. There is always something to talk about the game. I mean, that's started from having an interest in the game itself. It evolved much more beyond what happens on the football field. And we've even looked at some opportunities that are available to be able to make a living also out of football. That is how much invested, that is how much love that we have for the game. So I can tell you categorically that if you're tuning in right now, you're listening to two guys that have a huge passion for this game. And I can bet that it's going to be a very exciting time.
I mean, you know, it wasn't just that. It wasn't just that we watched football together, you know. The truth is, okay, fine. Eventually, we did not make it to professional playing, but we actually did also play together. But I want to take the history back to way back to when I actually even started, because, I mean, talking about our parents just made me remember that I started also watching football because sometimes around 1987, as long as I can remember, I remember that my dad left us in the house at one time when we were living in Ilorin then. He went to watch the Canada 87 final at our neighbor's house. And I remember he locked us in. we were not locked really, but I snuck out of the house and I was behind the neighbor's curtain watching the match. I was caught. You know, eventually, my dad was angry, but the neighbors begged and they allowed me to watch the match. That's the first match I remember watching. So I watched it with my dad. Then after then, where my curiosity started to become aroused was that he bought the first paper print that I read, which is, was it Complete Football? I can't remember, but I think it was Complete Football. So I read a lot about that Canada 87. I remember I hid that paper. I used that paper for a long time. So it was from there. I remember watching Maroc 88. And then in 1990, the Nations Cup, the World Cup. I didn't watch a lot of matches because then live broadcasts were not so many. But I remember Argentina's games from the World Cup and a few others, you know. But, I mean, here we are today, you know, thanks to our parents.
Thanks
to you also. Yeah.
I mean, talking about going down memory lane, I think that the lasting memory, one of the earliest memories, which has now turned out to be my own lasting memories, was USA 94. Two things particularly, and coincidentally, revolves around Roberto Baggio. Roberto Baggio getting that goal against Nigeria. The effect that I saw around the people around me, people that were jubilating a couple of minutes before, and then everybody went sad and quiet, you know, and everybody became very angry, irritated, and agitated until the end of the game. I mean, I just felt, okay, how could one man make everybody around me, just every mood around me change this way? The second incident was Roberto Baggio also missing that penalty in the final and standing there rooted and not being able to move. You see, beyond just watching football, I have now learned over the years that football has a whole lot of life lessons that a lot of people don't tend to give attention to. Because for me, those two incidents particularly taught me how to handle losses. Okay, in life, you can be the best. Because as at that time, when I started watching, Roberto Baggio was like God because of what he did to me in that sitting room that day. And then seeing him lose the penalty in the final and how he handled it also made me feel, oh, you can be the best and you still not win. And that's one of the beauties of football, because a number of people think we just talk football because we love it. We see 11 people. But then a whole lot of what happens on the football field are related to our everyday lives and how we go about it also.
Well, I remember that some of your friends about that time, or maybe after that time, started calling you Roberto Baggio. I remember Kau Tanko particularly call you. Yeah, used to call you. I remember I used to coach you guys as a team and he used to call you Baggio.
I mean, you know, Baggio then, after God, it just felt to me like it was Roberto Baggio, because I saw the mood. I knew what the mood was in our sitting room with everybody sitting, watching, everybody taking drinks, give me water, you know. And then suddenly this one man scored and everybody's mood changed. And I felt, okay, what is it about this man, about this game? I think that was the first time I got probably emotional about football, because before then I saw a little of Japan 93. I saw flashes of Italia 90, but it didn't really connect with me personally. I think that was the first time. And I mean, Baggio then, believe me, if you asked me after God, then I felt Roberto Baggio was the next best thing since sliced bread.
Well, I was in, I mean, I've Well, I was in Ijagbo then. I was schooling. I was in secondary school. You understand? I was in the boarding school. And while you were drooling over Robert Tubagio, I was crying. I was very ill, in fact. I was crying, you know, because it was a really painful loss. And, you know, I was with a lot of people who were not real football fans, and they didn't understand why I was crying. They all left me in the sitting room. I was there, and I was crying. You understand? So, I mean, for me, while you were learning how to handle a heartbreak, for me, I was having a heartbreak. You understand? to take it to another side a bit, just to digress a bit, I mean, concerning just now that you have spoken about so much in so much awe of Roberto Baggio, they were calling you Baggio. And at a point, Raul became like your best player, because I used to be a bit confused. I thought he was Roberto Baggio. Then later on, Raul became like the guy that you really adore so much. I mean, can you just shed a bit of light on who is actually the guy that stole your heart the most between Raul and Roberto Baggio?
Okay, I think it's Raul. And I'm smiling right now because even a couple of days ago, I had a post on my WhatsApp story talking about Raul, and a friend that I have known since we were very young sent me a message and said, immediately he read the first and second statement, he knew I was talking about Raul. And you see, like I said, I started, Roberto Baggio was that pain that I wouldn't say increased my interest in the game, but I just felt, okay, so Baggio is the next best thing since sliced bread. I happened to then watch a little of Euro 96, but not much. And then by the time France 98 was coming around, I was beginning to watch much more of club football also. So when Raul came out, first of all, I was fascinated about the name Raul because I felt it should have been Raul. And I was like, okay, so why are they calling it Raul when the name should have been Raul, ideally? Then getting into the World Cup, of course, again, he scored against Nigeria. And I was like, wow, this Raul guy. And I think from there on, I took on much more interest in him as an individual. My understanding of the game was also increasing. And I understand that, okay, yeah, while Roberto Baggio was very, very good, I came to realization that even in Roberto Baggio's generation, you can never say Roberto Baggio was the best of it all. But then maybe because I didn't have the opportunity to start watching Roberto Baggio much more often than, like I started watching Raul at that point in time. So, but the thing that caught my attention basically about Raul is someone that growing up, I try to find what was my strength as an individual in whatever I do. Like, okay, so I play football, like you rightly said. I was not particularly fast. I was not strong. I was not good in the air, you know? And then I just felt everything about me tends to circle around a Dennis Bergkamp kind of footballer or a Raul. And I think watching them, I just admire how Raul plays, how Raul moves, how Raul handles himself generally. And I just realized that whenever Raul's team loses, it kind of like hurts me more than anybody else. So, yeah, I just don't want Raul sad.
Okay. That's good. I mean, enough of Raul right now. I want to just take a call back to something that you said, which I really hold very important in my life because it has defined me as a person also. Learning lessons through football.
Yeah.
You know, over time, as I also grew in watching football, right, it became part of my story. It became part of my life. So a lot of times, I realize a lot of times when I make some comments about football, when I say something, a lot of people don't see what I see. A lot of people don't envision what I envision, because sometimes I look at football and I see savings. Sometimes I look at football and I see investment. Sometimes I look at football and I see kindness. You understand? And I don't believe that if you are really not immersed in football so much, you could really have these emotions. Football has taught me a lot, like you said, how to handle defeat. You know, we have this argument, we have banters, and then, you know, you've boasted about your club, this and that, and then your club loses 5-0, and you have to make an appearance tomorrow. I'm sure you had that kind of experience, particularly when Barcelona kind of dominating Madrid, you know. So, in summary about that, before we go back to maybe what's happening in the World Cup, you get, in summary, I believe that everything we do in life is an opportunity to learn. And from football, you can learn mathematics. From football, you can learn statistics. I don't know the number of times that I've had to Google statistics, that I've had to interpolate, that I've had to calculate averages based on the fact that I was just having a mere discussion, you know?
Yeah. So, and I'm glad that you're bringing us back to reality, because one can get lost in looking at memories, because if I have to admit that the memories have been very exciting. I mean, they've been very golden. Let me just put it that way. Getting back to modern day, and I'll start from memories again. When I started watching football, football was a game of four back line and a striker, a support striker, a right winger, a left winger, then attacking midfielder, defensive midfielder. The game has evolved over the years. I mean, a whole lot has happened. It has moved on now to different structures, different systems, different functionalities in different aspects and divisions of the game. But just to wrap it up on the memories, I'd like to know if you have to pick one moment in a World Cup, in the history of the World Cup, for what you, for the World Cup you have watched, one moment that I think you will define the World Cup for you, what would it be?
That's you see, the over the years, probably because I've seen a very good number of them. I mean, this is a very difficult one, honestly. I'll be very honest with you, because there are so many moments coming to a head. For instance, I just told you about how much I cried when that penalty was conceded by Austin Eguavoen in 1994. And I don't think that was the first and the only time that I think I have cried in football. I don't think I can cry anymore. You understand? That was a defining moment for me. But I mean, in general terms, I feel 2002 World Cup was a turning point in the history of World Cup a bit, because I feel from 2002, I felt a little bit of drop in quality. Like you were saying, football had changed a bit, and it shifted. Focus has now shifted, which I feel, I mean, focus has now shifted the players to the coaching. Yeah. Focus has shifted from the individual to the team. And I feel because of that, I feel we've lost a little bit of what used to be an entertainment in terms of individual break. Of standout players at World Cup after that time. Yeah, I think most of the focus is now on like team play after the exploit or that we saw from the performance we saw from like South Korea and in a number of teams. Understand? So yeah. I mean, those are two defining things for me. Yeah.
Okay, I mean, if I have to pick defining, I'll go back to Roberto Baggio again. I think those two moments I mentioned earlier are just key for me. So let's move into the recent today, and it's no secret that the World Cup is going on right now. I'd like to first start by giving a bit of a background and getting what your views are on it. The World Cup is being hosted in Qatar. There have been a whole lot of negative vibes. There have been a whole lot of discussion around how the bid was won, the weather, the humanitarian rights, everything back and forth has been said. I'm glad that at the end of the day, I think football is beginning to win, because all that is beginning to go into the background and we're talking much more about football. So I'm not going to give it much more time. I'm not going to give that any attention. But the only question I would like to pick out of this is this is a World Cup that we've had a whole lot of players injured. I think I read that it's the first World Cup since, I think, 1974, 1978, that the Ballon d'Or holder will not be participating. To even make the matter worse, the second Ballon d'Or will not be participating. So did you think that the level of injuries that we have had at this World Cup, although I think we've still had a very exciting tournament, but then it would have been good to see this level of stardust also. But do you think it has any effect on the fixtures and the fact that it's a winter World Cup?
Well, I always believe that the more the merrier, right? I always believe that the more the merrier. So, I mean, it's disappointing, for instance, to not have guys like Karim Benzema be able to play at this World Cup. And then what, that Liverpool striker, I was actually for Portugal. I was actually
Diego
looking
Jota.
forward to, yeah, seeing
Diego
Diego
Jota.
Jota, yeah, and guys like that really play. Yeah, but you see, the thing about the World Cup is whatever it is, whatever happens, players have always been missing World Cups due to injury. Even if they had played in the summer, there would still be some players who would get injured shortly before or shortly after. But we can't overrule the fact that players have been forced to play more games in a shorter time, something they are not used to. And I mean, I haven't done the research to know, I mean, the background, to know the back, I've not done the background research to know if, I mean, the number of matches it was has now caused this high number of injuries, or if it's just maybe an outlier or a coincidence, I wouldn't be able to, I mean, authoritatively say. But from the face of it, from the face of it, yes, one might suggest that. So, I mean, for researchers, that's a good theory to research on. But I think at the end of the day, we'll still have a good World Cup. We are still going to have players who are going to be revelations. There'll be opportunity for other people to play, you know. Well, not to, I just also want to go back a bit to the Ballon d'Or 1970. Was it 78 that did not play in the World Cup?
Yeah, I think it
And
was
as at that time,
78.
I think that was for a different reason though, not for injury. I think it was a political reason where Johan Cruyff, I think, refused to go and play in Argentina also. Reason. I'm not totally sure, but there was a discussion about what was happening at that time politically, you know. But it's really sad for guys like Karim Benzema, who has been off form, Diego Jota. France has also missed guys like N'Golo Kanté and Pogba, and that has also denied fans the opportunity of seeing more quality, seeing more excitement. But then, I mean, we have to look at the brighter side. It has opened the door for guys like Chua, Camavinga to also come. So we have to look at the brighter side because, I mean, we can't keep crying over this spilled milk.
Okay, so looking at the brighter side, I think the World Cup, if you ask me by my assessment, I think the games are beginning to pick up. I mean, a whole number of games start with probably both teams trying to size each other up. So we may not have seen a lot of early goals or a lot of goals in the first half. But then in the second half, when teams have to chase goals, we have seen goals, much more goals come up also in the second half. I have been particularly impressed about a couple of teams. Well, of course, Spain will be an obvious one because they scored seven. But beyond the fact that they scored seven, their general play, it was Costa Rica, I understand, but their general play was also very good for me. Would there be any other team that, particularly for you, at least everybody has played one game right now. Is there any team that actually stood out for you based on their team performance?
Well, I was impressed with the way Saudi executed that against Argentina to make sure that they go home with the points. That is probably the biggest upset in World Cup. I mean, the other upset would be Argentina losing to Japan, but Japan has been a
Germany.
regular participant. Japan has been doing better than Saudi over time in the World Cup. So I wouldn't say that is too much of a bigger surprise rather than the Saudi. I like the way they executed. And then to be honest too, I mean, Spain, not the scoreline, but the way they played. I mean, I wasn't expecting them to be so brilliant in their interchange. We know that they're technically brilliant, but I mean, I felt they had lost something after the last generation went. But Luis Enrique seemed to be putting a very good putting a very good team. This night we saw Brazil, and I saw a lot of individual talents, but I feel Brazil still left much to be desired because, I mean, if you look at their game, I was expecting much more in terms of delivery. I mean, to be fair, I think it was a game on the technical level. I think it was a game that was really brilliant in terms of both teams passing, ball control and how they tried to execute their game. But Brazil was not really so well. They didn't execute the game the way I expected, to be honest. And until the second goal came in, before I now really started seeing glimpses of what the talent in the team could do. While I do expect them to go far, I wasn't really impressed with the earlier parts of their game. So I feel the most outstanding thing was the result of Saudi against Argentina so far. Argentina was a bit disappointing.
I'm glad that you mentioned results particularly because life happened. I didn't get to watch the game live. I had to go and watch a replay. And, you know, when you watch a replay, having known this course, you have enough time to be able to look into the tactical aspect of the game. Unlike when you're watching it live, you see a whole lot of things clearer than when you're watching it live or the first time.
Yeah.
And I think that this was a very, some people have even said it's the biggest shock in the World Cup. It is probably is. But then it is a game that I think happens like once in 12, 16 years because Argentina may not have been at their best, but Argentina created enough chances to have won that game on another day. Yes, they had 3 goals written off, which were correct. They were offside goals and they could have done more. But you see, on the Saudi side, Saudi, I saw, was a team that was prepared for this game. They came out much more prepared for this game. But then within the first 5 minutes, they had 3 shots, they had 2 goals, and that was all. If you look at the XG, if you look at all other parameters in the game, you would wonder, how did Argentina lose this game? So ultimately, while the result is very impressive, the Saudi performance did not really cut it for me, because another day Argentina would have scored 2 or 3 and then we won't get to the point that we're having this conversation. And I don't mean to undermine their results. They declared a public holiday, which is fine. So I don't mean to undermine their result. But when you talk of performance, Spain particularly, take out the 7 goals, the movement of the ball. Again, I understand it is Costa Rica. And then Costa Rica did not particularly even make any effort to stop Pedri or Busquets. Busquets, a whole lot of people will tell you he's not the Busquets he used to be. I agree. But you see, if there is no pressure on Busquets, Busquets is still a fantastic footballer. And what Luis Enrique has been able to do successfully, particularly with Busquets, is that he structures his team such that Busquets is not under pressure. So you don't find Busquets oftentimes running or facing his goal. He's usually facing, and he usually initiates most of those of their movement. Even when he took out his team and rotated, they still played a very good football, because it's not like they did anything extraordinary against Costa Rica. What they just did was put ball in pockets and somebody is there. Put ball in pockets and somebody is there. I am not a big fan of Luis Enrique, but I saw their game and I thought, oh, that looked like a very good thing. Now, this is the caveat for Spain. Spain is a team that I am not sure of. They can be very good today and they can be very bad tomorrow. So I cannot necessarily stick out my neck for how Spain will perform in their next game against Germany. But to address the thing about Brazil, of course, Brazil is always favorites going into almost all the World Cup. And I still think they are favorites for this. You pointed out they have the best individual talents, and I agree with you. I have a worry about their defense line. But again, this is Brazil. I remember when Brazil went to the World Cup with Lucio Roque Jr. They had that back line. And I looked at that back line also, and I felt, oh, people will be able to breach this back line. But Brazil's tactics is always to defend by attacking. Like today, for instance, as potent as Mitrovic or Vlahovic with Milinkovic-Savic and Co, Tadic and Co can be, they did not have even a shot on target. So that's how Brazil plays. So if anybody thinks, Brazil may not have hit the standard of our expectation, but if anybody thinks that this Brazilian team is not a huge contender to be number one contender, I think you're making a huge mistake with them, because they defend by attacking and they have shown that they can always bring up guys and mix it up. Surprisingly, it is Richarlison that got the goal. I don't rate him on a personal note. Despite the fact that he got the goal, I still don't rate him. But even without him, I still think Brazil has enough in the tank to go all the way.
Well, to be honest, I feel the hallmark of a good coach is to be able to adapt, first of all. And I'll take it from Spain. You understand? Like, if you look at that, you spoke about Bushke. I feel the hallmark of a very good coach is to understand the strength and weakness of each player, and then to be able to maximize the individual strength within the team and reduce the weaknesses, which is what I give credit to Luis Enrique for. But like you said, my favorite is also Brazil for the World Cup. But I think what Luis Enrique did, Tite need to do more or do something like that for Brazil rather, so that they can, within the system, they can take advantage of the individual brilliance, you understand, to deliver wins, to deliver wins for the team. I saw a lot of time, I saw Neymar showboating when he's supposed to release the ball. I saw Vinicius trying to over dribble. And to be very honest, for about, like I said, for about 60-something minutes of the game, before the goal came, you would be wondering, what's Brazil doing, really? They were moving the ball around, yes, but they were not really doing anything. It wasn't like they were having any threatening shot. Most of those shots you spoke about came in the second half, particularly even after Neymar and Vinicius had gone out. That was when Casemiro played the shots. Exactly. Casemiro played the shots, hit the goal, you know. You understand? Even the first goal was more or less like a fluke. Vinicius, Neymar lost the ball. Vinicius quickly took a shot and then keeper dropped the ball and it was a tap-in. Brilliant second goal by Richarlison, though. But that cohesiveness was missing for most part of the game. That crisp movement that you expect from players with such high technical quality was missing in the final third, particularly. So for most of the time, those shots you were talking about, they were off-target shots, they were missed shots, they were misplaced, and some of them were wild shots. You get me?
Yeah, I do. And yeah,
while Brazil is also my favorite to win the World Cup, they must improve. Because, I mean, this first phase, you spoke about this first phase. For me, this first phase, and I read about what Carlo Ancelotti also said about it. This first phase is not really what I would call a very tough phase. Because most of the matches, yes, some of them you see one thing here or there, but there's really been nothing to move you to the edge of your seat, apart from maybe the result of Saudi Arabia. And I believe that as we move into the second round, when we separate the boys from the men and the business really starts, I believe the quality of the games that we are going to see will continue to improve.
Yeah, and I mean, talking about Brazil, we all know how Brazil does at international competitions. Brazil tends to get better as the game goes on. So hopefully some of the things that you have pointed out, they will be able to address that. And we'll be able to judge them when they play against a very top team also. There are three other teams that I think we have not mentioned that, well, they got the results. What did you say?
I want to add the usual controversial issue of Cristiano Ronaldo and Messi. Both of them went into their first game again and scored. So they are elongating the GOAT debate.
So I was even going to bring up conversation about three other teams that I think came as big teams and they got the results, but I want us to just talk about their performance a little. And that would be the Netherlands. You spoke a lot about cohesion when you're talking about Brazil, and I think the Netherlands gave enough of that, even though they do not seem to have the sharpness of getting the goals, but at least they won against Senegal. They got two goals. England got six. I didn't get to see the game, so I cannot necessarily speak to their cohesiveness. And France also, I saw the game for France. I felt France looked good, particularly coming from a goal behind. They created a whole lot of chances. You mentioned earlier the number of players they are missing, and we still have to put into consideration that the French national team is always a ticking time bomb. I mean, one Adrian Rabiot's mom could just do something, or Kylian Mbappe's dad could just do something, and then everything busts out. So, I mean, for them to come, having lost Karim Benzema, having lost Kimpembe, Varane not fully fit on the bench, Pogba, Kante, I felt their performance was also very impressive. They created a lot of chances. There was movement in attack, which is one thing that France generally, you would have looked at them in recent times, especially at the Nations League and then wonder how they are not able to move the ball around with the talents that they have. I also like to know what your perception is, particularly on these three countries, considering that they got the results, they are moving on to the second game right now, and their general well-being.
Okay, I'll start with France, right? We can look at France in two ways. They are missing quite a good number of quality players in the midfield, but we can look at it in two ways. It can be an advantage and it can be a disadvantage. Yeah, how it can be a disadvantage is, of course, obviously, the quality passes that the forward can receive from Pogba. The industry of Kante will not be there. And the new guys that are replacing them are a little bit less experienced. Tchouameni, maybe Kamavinga would get some games. Adrien Rabiot, not so dynamic. Antoine Griezmann now falling back to join the midfield to play some creative role. Yes, he could be creative, but when the push comes to shove, when you meet the big boys, when Griezmann is standing up against the Casemiro, I don't know how that French midfield would hold. But did you see the good side of it? I have always thought that the best way for the French to play is to play on the counter, because they had Karim Benzema and then they had Kylian Mbappe. So with Karim Benzema now out, I thought that with the pace of Kylian Mbappe, Kylian Mbappe's best chance of shining in this World Cup will be to do what Henry used to do, Thierry Henry, drop back into a sort of playmaking attacker role, and then destabilize the opponent with his pace. We know that Kylian Mbappe is very dangerous. People are more likely to mark him than mark Olivier Giroud. So he's likely to be able to drag two or three players here with his pace, with his movement, and be able to release passes to Giroud. So I thought on the counter, they are really going to be dangerous to many big teams, particularly teams like Spain, that want to hold the ball and pass the ball here and there. If they get their counter right, France will really, really be very dangerous. But if they get into a position where they lose midfield to a team that can really control midfield and also still finish well, they might find themselves in very big trouble. Well, as for Netherlands, we all know how pragmatic Louis van Gaal is. He's a very pragmatic manager. I wouldn't exactly say they are one of the favorites, but I wouldn't be shocked if they go far. They are cutting edge. They have issues with their cutting edge, but it was good to see Memphis Depay come back. He's like the fulcrum of their attack, one of the highest goal scorers in the history of the Dutch national team. With Gakpo, I don't think they are so bad compared to their peers, compared to, anyways, if for guys like Lewandowski, you hardly find a team that has real strikers that can pump in a lot of goals. And then that aside, the emphasis for most teams have shifted from having a center striker that will score a lot. It has shifted to everybody holding the ball, everybody passing the ball around. I thought they did a lot of good passing. And like you observed, yes, the cutting edge was a very big problem until they scored their first goal of the night. And I also think that knowing Van Gaal to be who he is, they would improve as the game goes on. Who was the third team?
England.
Okay, well, you see, England has got quality. I mean, in recent time, you understand, they've got quality. And one thing that also plays to their advantage now is that a lot of these players that England have now, they are still quite young, but they've got a lot of experience. It is not a surprise that they scored so many goals in their first match. And, I mean, that is what would be expected from a typical, English national team that has the kind of names and the kind of experience that they have. I'm really excited to watch them, but I am only skeptical for England about their coach, not even so much for the quality of their players. But one thing that I want to point out is the presence of Harry Maguire again. He was coming off the form of a very terrible season, probably the worst season of his life or the worst season that a player can ever have. But he's played in that team. When England starts to face Germany, if he's not on form, how would it impact on the team? Because you're trying to score, you concede because the player is off form, not making mistakes. I don't know if that choice was as a result of sentiment, but I certainly believe that the manager could do better, which makes me question what his choices will be. What kind of decisions will he be making going forward? I think the team is good. I think they can do very well. I don't have a problem with the players per se. They have a dynamic team. They can mix things around. They can mix things around. They can play in many different ways. But the capacity of the coach, when the team needs a tactical input, is what I doubt about England.
England. Yeah, I mean, I have my worries also on Gareth Southgate. I didn't get to see the game, but by the time I checked on live score, I saw that he had an attacking lineup, which was very strange for him, considering that he's the usually conservative manager. Five at the back. To address the Harry Maguire thing, I thought about it also before the competition, and I felt, okay, this is the captain of the team. He's not been playing regularly. What are the chances? What are the odds? What would I have done if I were in Gareth Southgate's shoes? And to be frank, as rich as England are in talent in other roles, they're not that rich when it comes to centre backs. The other options are John Stones, Conor Coady, Michael Keane, I think at Everton, then Tomori and Dier. Now, Dier is not a central defender for me. I mean, he does very well in a three-line defense. Conor Coady, at this level, I don't trust him. Same thing goes for Kane. Then you speak of Tomori, fine. That's an option. Maguire and John Stones. Okay, so if you're going to play with a back three, Tomori regularly does not play as a back three. I would have included him in that squad. But then, I mean, I look at his options and he will not have a strong argument for not picking Harry Maguire. We'll see how that comes with. Harry Maguire did very well in the first game, and that hopefully would help them again going forward. So two things now before we wrap up. One, the African countries I wouldn't say all lost, but the African countries did not get the right results. What are your take on that? What do you think is wrong with African football generally?
Well, from time, I mean, if you look back from time, Africans are hardly ever the most prolific teams when it comes to goal scoring at the World Cup. Yeah, we've had some brilliant attackers, brilliant strikers come out of Africa. Didier Drogba, Rashidi Yekini, Samuel Eto'o, as well as George Weah. We've had very good strikers who have done brilliant things in Europe. But when it comes to the national team, and if you look back, you will see that trend in Nations Cup over years, years and years and years again. Goal scoring has always been, that department, I don't know, has always been very difficult for Africans. You see good midfielders at the level of JJ Okocha, Kanu Nwankwo. I mean, you see them. But goal scoring has always been a problem, as it is this year. Well, Ghana was able to score too. I think Ghana did brilliantly against Portugal. I was disappointed by the performance of Portugal because I thought on paper Ghana did not really have a very fantastic team, and they could have stolen they could have snatched a draw if not for that crazy, move by Inaki Williams. He had the opportunity to really pull that match level, but I mean, he just failed. Why? I cannot explain. Yeah, and Morocco drew. Tunisia also drew, and you know, if you watch both teams, they are really very good technically, but again, that cutting edge is hardly ever there for African teams. Yeah, it's hardly ever there. The only thing I could say for Senegal is maybe if Sadio Mane was there, because they really put up a very good performance. They were unlucky to just concede. Well, yeah. a second goal later came in, but I feel it was the first goal was what broke the camel's back. Maybe they had a player the quality of Sadio Mane, who is probably the best forward in Africa now, alongside Salah, who is not in the World Cup. You know, maybe. But African teams really need to improve their sharpness in front of goal. But to be very honest, in terms of quality, I kind of feel that this is one of the most average African representation when it comes to maybe quality of individual players.
I quite agree with you also. I saw Senegal, I saw Ghana, I also watched Tunisia play, and I will not say they were, I mean, like they were, the opponents were much better than them. No, the games looked very balanced. I think they gave a good account of themselves. And I always wonder why, because it is not just about this World Cup. Even when you look at previous World Cup, when we get to that level, at underage competitions, we'll score the goals, we'll do very well. And then we'll get to that peak level of the World Cup. And then it feels like the stage, we're overawed by the stage. You would see that a whole lot of Africans tend to lack composure when it gets into the final third. In fact, you know, when Inaki Williams did not take that chance, it was what came to my mind. Okay, Inaki is somebody that we can actually say, we wouldn't actually say he's African. Yeah, he had the Ghanaian parenting, but he did not develop here. So because I was beginning to think that could this have been mental? Could it have been? But then we'll see what it is. I hope that at least the representation of Africa at least will have one team. Hopefully, like you said, if Sadio Mane were fit, probably Senegal would have been the team to fly African flag. But let's wrap up today's episode. Back to something that you mentioned earlier, the Cristiano Ronaldo, Lionel Messi, Chelsea competition. So they've both gotten one goal. Cristiano's team won, penalty. Lionel Messi's team also, Lionel Messi's team lost. We'll see how the next game goes. Do you have any thoughts to share about that before we wrap up?
To be very honest, like we are all seeing, both players are at the end of their careers. They are getting to the end of their careers. Their influence, their impact is reducing, is waning. I mean, it would be nice to see at least one of them win the World Cup. I mean, people have been talking about how winning the World Cup will settle that debate. I don't believe that winning the World Cup will settle the debate, really. But to be very fair, we've always been talking about, oh, you won title, this one won that title. But I always believe that title is a team thing. But these are two men who, over 15 to between 15 and 20 years, they've given us a lot. And I just feel they should just enjoy this World Cup. We as fans should also enjoy it, because it's probably the last time we're going to be seeing both teams play. But one thing that I would love, that would have been very interesting for me, would have been to see those two teams play against each other.
Each other, right? Yeah, I had that thought. In fact, I sat down to do the simulation. I wondered what sort of results they would have, so that at least they'll play against each other. It'd be good to see it. But hey, going back to what you said earlier, forget it. Winning the World Cup will settle the debates. In fact, it will settle a whole lot of a whole lot more than just the debates between both of them. Now, these are two GOAT candidates, not just against each other, but candidates against all time. Now, considering that our generation watched these guys, you would understand why our generation will think these guys are the greatest of all time. And you can't blame anyone for saying that. I mean, I saw Cristiano Ronaldo for years. He brought me a whole lot of happiness. He brought me a whole lot of joy. This is somebody that I learned a whole lot of qualities that I took from how he lives his life and how he does, that I used in my own personal life. So it is understandable if at the end of the day, I feel, oh, this guy is a greater influence to me and is a GOAT than probably Pelé or Diego Maradona. And I can tell you, winning the World Cup would settle a whole lot of debate beyond just a debate between both of them.
Well. You see, comparing players, I've always said this, comparing players along generations is always very different and difficult, because you see a lot of the people who are saying Messi greatest of all time today, Ronaldo greatest of all time today, never, ever, ever saw Maradona. So I always say that there's no problem with comparing players. Comparison will always be there forever. But when you want to compare, you have to have a set of parameters. You understand? You have to have a set of parameters that put everybody on the same scale. And I do not think that winning World Cup is really that parameter. Even though we give it to Pele that, okay, he is the common factor between three winning teams. You understand? I always believe at the end of the day that when you want to pick out a player as the greatest player, whatever you're comparing should be the attributes of the player. And for me personally, you know, I engage in the debate out of banter. I always believe that Diego Maradona is the greatest. And the reason is very simple. The reason is because of his influence. Diego Maradona, like I've always said, is the only player among them who can play with a very weak 10 and still win. The others need a lot, they needed a lot more quality. Diego Maradona is the only one that has been a smaller team at the good club level and then at the national level, national team level. If you look at the Garinchas, the Vavas, the Didis that Pele played against, well, top quality. If you look at the guys, guys that Messi played with, even in both Argentina and over the years in both, they were golden generation. Even at Barcelona and at Argentina, you'll be shocked that those guys, Tevez and Co, they never won anything at Argentina. But Diego Maradona, you will always only remember maybe Valdano and Burrechaga, and that's it. If you go to Napoli, it's always the same thing. So the parameters are always, I always believe he's always had more influence than anybody. He's been more inspirational than any player in football. He's the only one that you can look at and say he's a one-man riot squad in football. I don't think anybody has ever, any individual has ever dominated football based on his own personal attributes as much as Maradona has. But, you know, these are still subjective.
I hear you. You said something that's, I find very, very wrong, that you don't have to win the World Cup to be the greatest of all time. But we don't have time today to debate on that. I can bet you, listeners, that that is where we'll start our next episode.
Before we go, I would like to correct that. I'm not saying it doesn't add something, but I'm just saying that titles generally, when we look at titles generally, titles is a function of team, not a function of that individual.
Okay, my position, though, is this. If you don't have the World Cup title as a footballer, I don't think you should be considered as the greatest. I mean, you can be one of the GOATs, but I don't think you should be considered as the greatest. To be the greatest, you have to be part of a team that won the World Cup. Because Brazil won 2002 World Cup. Ronaldo de Lima contributed. If you go back to the Pele years, there is no way you that gets to the level of being a candidate will not have contributed to your team immensely to winning the World Cup. So it's as good as, yes, you won the World Cup for your country. So for you to be in that category of discussion of greatest of all time, I mean, that one person, you have to win the World Cup for me.
So supposing this year, Messi doesn't win, Ronaldo doesn't win, and then next World Cup, Messi is 40, he sits on the bench and he wins. That's it.
Okay, so you see, the point is now this. If Messi is good enough to go to the World Cup, at that, if you're a GOAT candidate, there are some leverages that comes to you. If Messi is good enough to go for that World Cup, Messi would play at that World Cup. Now, if Messi plays at the World Cup, for Argentina to win, there is no way Messi would not have contributed. If you look back at all the World Cups, whomever may have won, whatever player we are looking at, in that category of players, not just any player now, but any player in that category of being called, oh, he's a great, they tend to contribute to the World Cup. They just don't go to the World Cup.
I agree with you, but at 40 in 4 years' time.
That's what I'm still saying, that in 4 years' time, if Messi goes to the World Cup, Messi would still play. And for Argentina to win with Messi playing, Messi would still have done something that will make Argentina to win. That's the point I'm making. So
He may play in a few games, but not have the kind of influence. You understand?
He may not have the kind of influence he has had in the past.
Rojamila in his last World Cup.
Yes.
Robert Jamila would be one of probably the greatest player to ever come out of, debatable, in Cameroon, and one of the best to ever have come out of Africa. His last World Cup, he was mostly sitting down on bench. Yes, he came off the bench. He even scored in one of the games, but you wouldn't say he was a starter or he was much of an influencer. You get my point? So if Messi
had gone
on to win it like that, will that make him...
Okay, so let me now use the same Rojamila to explain my point on Messi. Rojamila played the 1980 World Cup as a 40 years old. As a 40 years old, did Roger Miller not still score goals for Cameroon? Today, when you look back, you remember some things about that World Cup. And when it comes to Cameroon, Cameroon beats Argentina. Cameroon got to quarterfinal. What is the next thing that you remember? Roger Miller got goals. Did Roger Miller not get one or two goals? Fine. If Messi gets to Argentina, if Messi is good enough to go to the World Cup for Argentina, and mean at that level, Messi gets to play in a couple of games. Even it could be dead rubber games, it could be quarterfinal or semifinal, and Messi makes a difference. Messi scores goals. I mean, it doesn't mean Messi carries them all through the World Cup. The days of carrying like Diego Maradona has passed. Football has evolved. It is rare to see any team nowadays that one individual would carry anymore. It's structural. Football now is within a structure.
That is why I attribute more points to those guys who were individual.
I understand where you're coming from. But to now address what you said earlier about generations, the generation has changed. It would be unfair to judge this generation because they are not that individualistic, because the game does not permit it anymore. That's the point I'm making. So, but if Messi is part of a team that goes on to win the World Cup, Magana Yakari, I give it to him. But you have to win the World Cup for me. Now, if we now take the World Cup out, I can then start having a conversation around Ronaldo and Messi. Anyways, we don't have much time anymore. We'd like to wrap it up at this point. Jide, final word before we wrap it up?
Well, I mean, it was good to have this discussion because we haven't actually really spoken about football for a while now. So, well, I hope we are able to do this more often. I'm looking forward to this, the knockout stage of this World Cup. I know that we'll have a lot of things to talk about. And I like the fact that we actually even shared the background that we shared. And I hope that we can even do more of that.
All right, guys, we'll still get through to you before the knockout stage. Hopefully before the end or by the end of the second round, we'll come to you with another episode. See you soon. Take care. Bye.